For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
There are reports that maybe 25-26% of patients on long-term opioids in general practice have opioid dependence that is unrecognised.
That was Dr. Pallavi Prathavadi, a GP and PhD candidate at Monash University. Dr. Prathavadi and her colleague, Dr. Liz Sturgis, have written an article for the MJA arguing that the time has come to make opioid agonist therapy a normal part of general practice. At a time when 56% of unintentional opioid deaths now involve pharmaceutical opioids, finding a way to encourage GPs to become agonist prescribers is an urgent challenge. Dr. Prathavadi and Dr. Sturgis are my special guests today. What is an opioid agonist?
Basically, what we're talking about is the medical treatment for opioid dependence and addiction. And it's two medications, methadone and buprenorphine, that we're really talking about, colloquially called Suboxone. And basically, in the past 20, 30 years ago, when we spoke about opioid agonist treatment, we were really talking about treatment for heroin addiction and how to get them off illicit opioids and onto a pharmaceutical treatment that didn't cause the highs but treated the actual physical chemical dependence.
So it's an alternative, in a sense, to an opioid.
Yes. So depending on the type of use. So it wouldn't be, we're not talking about opioids used to treat pain. We're talking about the treatment for opioid dependence or addiction.
The way they're helpful to patients is that it stops people having a withdrawal, basically, from opioids. So you give them the steady dose of methadone and buprenorphine. They don't have the withdrawal effects, and then so don't feel triggered and needing physiologically to use. So you get rid of the withdrawal effects.
There are probably many circumstances in which we would think about these medications. It would possibly be a treatment for people that have addiction to illicit opioids like heroin as a safer alternative to heroin as the opioid. And we could monitor it closely and support people from a medical point of view. But what we're talking about in this particular article is also the treatment of pharmaceutical opioid dependence and addiction. So instead of those pharmaceutical opioids, we would be treating addiction or dependence on a chemical level with these opioid alternatives. It's different to naloxone because naloxone is the treatment for overdose toxicity. Naloxone is a reversal agent, while this would be treating chemical addiction or dependence.
What is the situation with opioid dependence in Australia today? What's happened in the last 20 years or so?
It's actually more in the last 30 years where we've just had dramatically increasing rates of opioid, pharmaceutical opioid prescriptions. Yep. And at the same dramatic increase in prescription rate, we're also seeing opioid-related morbidity and mortality. And while the drivers of opioid-related morbidity and mortality used to be illicit opioids, it's very much pharmaceutical opioids now.
Well, do we know why?
For a variety of reasons. Firstly, there's increasing number and type of opioids on the PBS. So there's increasing availability, access is easier. We have increasing rates of chronic pain, and opioids have been used, whether there's a role or not, to treat that. There is difficulty accessing non-pharmacological options like physiotherapy or hydrotherapy or psychotherapy for chronic pain management. There's difficulties accessing medical care, and perhaps pharmaceutical options are used to manage the pain. There may not be suitable non-opioid options, for example, an elderly person who can't take anti-inflammatories. It's a very complex system, many, many drivers. There isn't a one fix to end it.
I gather from your paper that the pharmaceutical opioid unintentional deaths has now risen above that of heroin.
Correct. Wow. Pharmaceutical opioids are now involved in over 50% of opioid-related deaths, more than heroin, and like two to three times more than methadone. So the whole narrative around opioid-related harm has really changed. Liz and I are both GPs, and a lot of our interest is how much of this is coming from primary care and general practice. And there are reports that maybe 25-26% of patients on long-term opioids in general practice have opioid dependence that is unrecognized.
And Liz, what the unanswerable question is, what do we do about, I mean, obviously we want to help those people who are dependent to get them off that dependence track. But is there something we should be doing in primary care to prevent this happening in the first place?
I mean, that's a really good question. And I'm a GP and I prescribe methadone to my patients. But mostly the people who are accessing things like methadone and Suboxone are people who've had those problems with street heroin and street fentanyl and that sort of thing. And that's sort of where we really recognise our role as prescribers. But this paper is really getting it out there, you know, is there a broader role than that? So if people have pain and they are reaching for their opioid medication, not really now as a pain issue, but as a more a dependency issue, maybe methadone and Suboxone can help us treat those patients a little better and we think a bit more broadly about it.
So why isn't it happening more?
It's a tricky one. To become a methadone prescriber as a GP in Australia now, you have to jump through quite a few hoops. So I've done it now in 3 different states and territories to be able to prescribe for my patients. Often the training isn't available at an easy to access time. What that kind of sets up is this sort of feeling that it's something that's really difficult to do. I mean, usually when we put up extra barriers like that, it means that there's stuff that's really, really hard to do. And as a regular GP, it's not something you can achieve. But as a prescriber, I don't think that's really true. There are really very good safe protocols around these medications. And we work extremely closely with our pharmacy colleagues. So there is a safe system. And I think maybe the system we've set up is a little too bureaucratic for actually what needs to happen.
It's a very controlled dispensing system as well, isn't it? People have to come every day or whatever to get their dose. Is that fair enough? Or could we make the dispensing of it easier as well?
There are different rules between different states and territories, which always makes you wonder, is this really a needed thing or is this, again, a bureaucratic thing? So I think Victoria has some of the best kind of dispensing arrangements for patients where, for instance, for Suboxone, they have to go in every day for the first 2 weeks but then can access takeaways after that. Methadone's a little trickier. We worry about storage at home and other people accessing it like children. But again, you know, we allow patients to take home boxes and boxes of OxyContin without these same kind of restrictions on access. Don't really make sense from a medical point of view, and maybe there's other systemic stuff happening under there.
What are the safety profiles of methadone and Suboxone? How safe are they in themselves in terms of overdose or overuse or toxicity?
They're still opioids at the end of the day, and definitely there's a lot of qualitative work showing that one of the barriers to GPs prescribing these medications is their worry about the side effect profile or the toxicity. But we still know from Australian numbers that the mortality rate is significantly higher with pharmaceutical opioids rather than opioid agonist treatment. You could almost argue it's a lesser of two evils and that it would still be the safer option for someone with opioid dependence or addiction, and certainly safer than declining to prescribe pharmaceutical opioids and then a person seeking illicit opioids to manage their symptoms.
I'm chatting with Dr. Pallavi Prathavadi and Dr. Liz Sturgis, 2 GPs with a special interest in treating opioid dependence. Their co-authored perspective can be read at mja.com.au. If you are enjoying this podcast, drop me a line and tell us what you think. You can find me at C Swanell, that's C, S for Sam, W-A-N-N-E-L-L, at mja.com.au. Or you can find us on Twitter at the MJA. Subscribe to our feed on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Back to our chat. How expensive is it?
Methadone and other treatments are actually not available on the PBS. It's a bit shocking. Some states and territories provide cost support for patients at the pharmacy level. So pharmacists, they can charge as they wish, and depending on their own costs of providing the medication and if their state or territory provides any support, then they pass on those or not to the patient. My patients have told me it can range from sort of $30 a week is probably a really cheap access through to $10 a day plus in some pharmacies. And the patients are told things like, well, it's cheaper than your heroin was, which my patient tells me, you know, it's a really a false economy because they were doing crime and things to get heroin and they don't want to be doing that to get methadone. So it's a real shame it's not available on the PBS, and it would be amazing if people could access it instead under PBS cost.
Let's go over the barriers to getting GPs prescribing this stuff more regularly. Obviously, there's the extra training issue and perhaps the misleading message that it's a bit more difficult than it actually is, and the cost. So what else is stopping GPs from becoming prescribers?
There's a lot of reluctance to be the only GP at a clinic prescribing this, or the only GP in a local area prescribing this, because of fears that they will become known as the methadone prescriber and that there will be a lot of patients who are also demonstrating drug-seeking behavior, and then that clinic gets a reputation as being will prescribe opioids. And we see this in lots of different areas of medicine where outlier behavior or being the only GP prescribing that, providing a service, can be a barrier. Particularly in opioid prescribing, this is what I've done in a lot of my doctoral research, is that opioid prescribing practices of an individual GP very much reflected by the clinic's culture. And GPs in a clinic tend to prescribe opioids in similar ways. Either all the GPs in the clinic tend to be conservative prescribers, or they tend to all be higher prescribers. So one of the strategies that Liz and I were also suggesting in this paper is addressing this sole prescriber idea and providing educational interventions or helping entire clinics with whole practice teams of GPs to become able to prescribe and interested in prescribing.
Because there's a huge stigma, isn't there?
That stigma still exists. I mean, to be honest, there's a lot of stigma right across drug addiction for patients, for carers, for GPs, and definitely in the area of opioid prescribing.
Liz, do you still see it in your practice? Is there a stigma around the patients who come to you? Is it difficult to have other patients around them? Are they well treated?
Yeah, at the moment I work in a practice where we only look after people with drug and other alcohol and other drug addictions. So it's a service being set up pretty much in response to difficulty accessing care in other places. I mean, often my patients have, you know, severe and enduring mental illness. They have other chronic health issues, things that mean they need more time and quite a space where they tend to do a little bit better with their health care. When I trained 10 years ago now, I was lucky to work part of my training time in a practice set where a lot of the GPs were methadone prescribers, and that's where I kind of got grown up and enculturated into, you know, this is something GPs do, you can do it, it's not a hard or more difficult than anything else. And I think that's where it's come from for me. But I'd say there is definitely a stigma around what patients experience themselves, but then also GPs being unsure, being a little frightened to get involved in what that might mean for their own practice. Like we spoke about in the paper, if we make it more, you know, this is something GPs do, this is something we all do, sharing that burden, changing the culture and the stories we all tell ourselves around these patients, it could go a long way to improving care for a lot of people.
Wave a magic wand for me, Pallavi. What would you do if you had all the power in the world?
To be honest, I love the idea of what France did, which we've discussed in the paper.
Mm-hmm. What did they do?
So basically they had a very similar system to Australia with lots of administrative barriers and long processes to become accredited in prescribing opioid agonist treatment. Mm-hmm. And then they got rid of most of the bulk of that and made it far easier for prescribers to prescribe. And then all of a sudden, within 12, 24 months, there were significantly high rates of prescribing of methadone. I think we quoted in our article that 1 in 4 French physicians were prescribing opioid agonist treatment, from similar numbers to what we were seeing in Australia. And then over 60% of people with opioid addiction were now on treatment. It's a great model for us to consider following because it really highlights once you start normalizing it and reducing as many barriers, you can see an outcome.
Liz, what about you? Get your little golden wand out for me. What would you do?
I would put methadone and Suboxone on the PBS, without a doubt. It reduces the cost for patients, makes it part of normal pharmacy, GP care, and I think that would make access a lot easier for a lot of people.
What has to happen for those things to happen? I mean, are governments open to this? Is there a conversation going on with the policymakers and the colleges, for example? Are they into this?
Again, this is something that I've kind of considered in my research. There's never going to be one particular avenue to improve opioid prescribing in any area. And the way we like to consider it is on different levels. So the practitioner level, the patient level, the clinic level, and systems levels. Yeah. So systems levels, we're talking about things like what Liz is saying, get it on the PBS and get more policy happening to normalize it and make it acceptable. And then practitioner level, improving confidence as well as knowledge, as well as opportunity to engage and become a provider of these services, which if you put it in the context of changing entire clinic behaviors, which is what we were talking about before, all of a sudden you've gone from improving prescribing in one provider to maybe 10. And then all of the possible incentives to make this happen, whether they're financial incentives or just access. The example I like to give is in Victorian registrar training, at least, they often have Saturday workshops to develop additional skills. I remember attending one in Implanon Insertion, and most of my GP training year had attended that Saturday morning workshop. By Saturday afternoon, we were accredited in Implanon Insertion. It would be very easy to run something similarly for registrars in opioid agonist treatment Saturday morning, and then we're done. And then you just make this part of a training opportunity.
And are the colleges up for that?
The colleges, I think, very much support us improving skills in this area. There are already educational programs and training offered by the RACGP through the CPD programs, through lots of primary health networks, but there is still going to be reluctance in engaging with these if the GPs don't see the value or they don't see that they are going to be able to prescribe afterwards. Sometimes I think that delivering these opportunities and interventions en masse right across the country might make it easier than offering a local session.
So maybe the medical schools need to get involved as well?
That's a great opportunity. Some of the GPs were suggesting in my interview work that I had done that if you start putting these questions on RACGP exams, you will change the attitude of registrars and make them think this is something that is necessary and part of the skill set of a GP fellow. The one point we hadn't made was that this is going to be shared with our pharmacist colleagues. Basically, this is a teamwork. We will prescribe, but our pharmacist colleagues dispense. You can take away GP barriers and change our behaviors, but if we don't have the similar cultural shift and interventions for our pharmacist colleagues, I don't think we're going to see the same results.
Do they have the same barriers to wanting to dispense that GPs have to wanting to prescribe?
Yeah, pharmacies have to be kind of accredited in dispensing. As a GP, it's a really quite an easy protocol for me of how to write the script. It's the pharmacist that sees the patient every day and works out the daily dose within the confines of the script. So it is a highly sort of skilled part of pharmacy work. That's probably very undervalued. Depends on there's very varying rates across Australia in different communities of how many pharmacies are available to dispense. And again, also varying. Mm. Some hospital clinics provide dispensing service. And again, that's region to region dependent.
Thank you both.
Thanks very much for this opportunity. It's been great.
My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.